Welcome to our third session on policing Pittsburgh with Dr. Elaine Frenz from Kent State University. We've had a wonderful series so far, and we're looking forward to today when we get into the 20th century. So thank you, Elaine, and here we go.
Hello, thank you so much, Sarah and Ted, and thanks, Bill, for doing the tech. So, okay, great. So now we finally get to the part that I'm actually most interested in, which is the progressive era, moving from the Civil War. We're covering a big period of time today. We're moving from the Civil War, and we're moving all the way into all the way up to World War One. And this is a huge time in the development of policing. And it really is arguably when you get a modern police, right? So are many elements that are going to start looking much more familiar to today's police. So this is really maybe the most important of the four in many ways, of the four periods of time. So just to give you a sense of where we start, the earliest, the closest time I could find to look at the status of the police, the first annual report I could really find from this period was 1868. And at that point, we have the creation of the first combined force. And what that means, and that's really important in the history of the modern police, because remember how until now you had a day police, you had the constables, and then you had the night police, and they were always at war. You know, they were always like criticizing each other and trying to figure out who can get the fees. And there were some times when they were told they're not allowed to collect fees, but you know, they often were collecting fees for service really until 1868, and honestly after that as well. But when, you know, it's 1868, when you have the first sort of combined force, there's one police, they're in charge of everything altogether. One man, one chief presides over them. And it just gets to be a lot more organized than it had been. There's a chief of police, and the chief of police is paid like a professional. He gets $1,500 a year, which is a good salary. And then you get also a bunch of, you had some officers before over the watch, but you now get more officers, sort of mid-level managers. You get a police captain who's working at $2.35 a day. You get lieutenants who are $2.25 a day. And then the police themselves are paid $2 a day. And they might work during the day, or they might work during the night. They do not get any paid days off. If you take off, you don't get paid. They often are working every day, right? So it's, just like, everybody's going to have to take a day off sometime just because they're sick or whatever. But when you do take a day off, you just don't get paid for that day. So they have really a difficult work situation. It's a very physical job. altogether in 1868, there's going to be 100 people on the police force. So you could see it's really, increased as the size of Pittsburgh is expanding. The size of the police is expanding. You're up to 100 man force. It is still 100 men. During this time, one thing we're going to do is start getting a couple of police matrons, but we don't have them yet in 1868. Each of these police officers is appointed by the mayor. The mayor appoints each one, and council approves the appointment. If the council doesn't approve the appointment for any reason, then the mayor has to appoint someone else, and then the council has to approve them, right? The reason they do it like that is that these are very much patronage jobs still, right? So it's expected that the police has a relationship to the mayor and to council. The police often sort of are involved in elections. Like, they might show up at elections, they might help people get out to vote, right? Things like that. So it's, that's very common, right? It's machine politics. We're more familiar thinking about it happening in maybe Boston or New York, but the same thing is happening here in Pittsburgh. So it's a machine politics system, and the police are not only really important people as far as keeping order, but they're important people as far as keeping party order, right? You know, so the one great thing about becoming mayor or being on council is you get to have part of this patronage, get to have people sort of working for you, the police. However, I'm going to actually get a little bit more complicated after the Civil War, because one thing that's going to happen is, who do you think is going to be the police after the Civil War, right? It's going to all be veterans. It's going to almost all be veterans coming into that force. And they have a bit of a clout, right? As veterans of the Civil War, people think that they're pretty important. And some of them, you know, have been injured or, you know, have problems, you know, as veterans, a lot of mental illness, and it wasn't called that at the time, but it was understood that, you had to sort of take extra care of, you know, of your police, of the veterans, and a lot of them became police officers. So there does start to be a little bit more sort of social sympathy for the police, and it gets to be a little bit harder to just ditch them every time there's a new election, right? So the police themselves are starting to pick up a little bit of dignity, sort of as an institution, in part because of their status as veterans. The police are going to have plenty of challenges to face during this period, right? That Pittsburgh is growing very rapidly, right? This is the great period of Pittsburgh's growth. And there's also just a huge amount of social chaos. And so let's just review a little bit of what's going on. And Bill, I'm ready now for... I'm going to try to keep this, my phone, for whatever reason. Okay, there we go. Okay, now this doesn't look like social chaos to us, maybe, when we look, but these people were actually very important, and they were a real force of chaos. And so basically what happens in 1874, it starts actually in 1873. How many people are familiar with the Temperance Crusade? Yay. Okay. Yes. So in 1873-4, and I don't know why people don't know more about this, but it was a national movement. It covered the front page of every newspaper in the country for like a couple months, right? In the spring of 1874, the winter and spring of 1874. And it was a national movement to stop male drinking, right? And it was a movement by women. And we're not going to talk too much about these guys. I have another book about this. This was my first project, right? But it actually is what brought me to policing. But what happens is they all go out. It starts in Ohio. It's big in Pittsburgh. These women go out and they wear their white dresses, and they march out to the saloons, and they demand that the saloons stop selling liquor. Now, how this relates to policing is that these women are demanding order, right? These women are demanding social order. And when they complain, you know, and they go out into the streets in groups in Pittsburgh, you know, hundreds of women, sometimes with a couple of ministers, like that dude's probably a minister. I actually forgot to check before I put it on the slide, but, you know, he's some sort of minister. But it was the women would lead the way, and there'd be this sort of pack of supportive men behind them. And they would go out and they would kneel in front of the saloons and they would sing hymns. They were many of them were Presbyterian. It was actually a big Presbyterian movement, among other things. And they would demand that the saloon shut down. Now, in many places, rural areas, like where it started, this worked. And actually, a lot of saloons did shut down temporarily, right? It didn't change the world. But then they also demanded like new laws, things like that. It was hugely impactful. In Pittsburgh, and in cities in general, they didn't do so well. And they didn't do so well because immigrants, you know, fought back, right? And, you know, attacked them, right? And so there'd be these brawls and people were dumping, feces and stuff out of their windows on them. And like, you know, the saloon keepers would get their wives to attack them, you know, and things like that. So it got really serious, but also these women were, doing something that was sort of detrimental to the economy. You know, the saloon economy was really big. And so the police are actually mobilized to arrest these women. And they do. And it's actually, it's crazy when I read it. I'm always just, even though I read it for so many years, I'm always surprised, but they're singing hymns as they're like in the cells, you know, and it's like the civil rights movement, but it's these like women from 1874. The reason this is important to policing, first of all, the police sort of are dragged out to have to like arrest these, you know, these mothers, you know. But then secondly, what the women are demanding is order on the streets. They're demanding we should be allowed to walk down the streets without being harassed by drunken men, right? They're demanding, but they're also demanding protection from domestic abuse. Right. What this really is, in many different ways, what this really is the first sort of anti domestic abuse movement. And so they're saying you have to shut down these saloons so that men don't beat us, you know. And so the police, so one thing that's happening during this time is that, and I'm just bringing this up as one example, they lose, right? You know, they go out and the police do arrest them, and this movement lasts for just a few months. You know, by the end of 1874, it's petered out, but it gives rise to what? Something that probably we've all heard of. What they all form into a permanent organization, the biggest organization, the biggest women's organization of the 19th century, which is, anybody know the biggest women's organization of this? They're so much bigger than the suffragists. They're like more than four times bigger than the suffragists. The WCTU, the Women's Christian Temperance Movement Union, the Women's Christian Temperance Union emerges out of this, and they end up pushing for this. So this is all to say, looking over the police's shoulders, and I think when we talk about policing, I was just thinking about this as I worked on this paper. When we talk about policing, we should always be talking, because Ted asked this great question. Well, you know, what about the women? And I'm like, oh, well, they're not really, you know, when we're talking about policing, we should always be talking about women, because women are giving that pressure often on policing to suppress disorderly men, right? You know, always it's like the women who are just like, you have to take care of these disorderly men, whether in public or maybe even in my home, you know, to protect me. So the police, so one thing that's giving rise to this increasing policing is sort of the pressure of women. You know, and I think that's probably still true today, right? So we should talk, I wanted to start with this, but so this is a big deal in Pittsburgh. You got the Temperance Crusade of 1874, but, and incidentally, you notice that woman over there is Mrs. E.W. Gormley. Anybody know the president of Duquesne right now is Gormley? I bet that's an old Pittsburgh family. These women tended to be pretty well positioned. So I don't know that, but that's my guess. Okay, Bill, could we go forward? Okay. Anybody know what this is? Familiar? 1877, massive national strike, right? Where Pittsburgh was one of the centers of it. It's the railroad strike of 1877. The railroad companies cut, basically there's a big depression in the 1870s, starting in 1873. The railroads are going to cut the pay of the railroad workers. So there's a huge national strike, the first big national strike. It really could have been, it could have ended very differently, right? You know, and people like, you know, people, very high level people in the country thought there was going to be a revolution right at this moment. There was a danger that the federal government was going to run out of soldiers to send in to the different cities where the police couldn't handle the strikes, right? That was a very serious danger. So it was a big deal strike, and Pittsburgh was one of the centers of this. And basically there were no police to respond to this. Because there were police in Pittsburgh, obviously, but they sympathized with the strikers very largely, right? So they wouldn't work. They wouldn't come out to suppress it. They tried to call out the Pittsburgh militia, and the Pittsburgh militia sympathized with the strikers, so they wouldn't come out. You know, they actually tried to call out a posse. You know, sheriffs have the right to call it a posse, and they tried to call it a posse, and people wouldn't come out to join the posse. So they basically, like, you know, couldn't get anyone to suppress the strike. They had to call in, guess who? Philadelphia, right? They had to call in the Philadelphia militia, right, which had to make its way over to Pittsburgh. And ultimately, they did successfully suppress the strike. But basically, by the end of the day, about $5 million of damage in Pittsburgh, as buildings were like this railroad depot are burned down. It was largely in the Strip District, but it was all over the place, along the railroad lines. And there was also 24 people killed in Pittsburgh, including 20 civilians and four members of the Philadelphia Guard that came in. So it was, they camped out like during the strikers during this took over land and built a, they had tents and they built, it was a really, really, really big deal, right? It could have ended very differently. And so basically what happens after this is that there's a lot of, for those people who were not pro-striker, right? Those folks get a lot more interested in having a more disciplined police force and a larger police force so that they could suppress strikes. Now, this was the biggest strike, but there were strikes all the time, especially in Pittsburgh, right? This is like strike country right here. Like every year there's strikes. And as you look through the annual reports of the police force, every year they list how many strikes there were that they had to work on, right? That's part of their annual report. But not only that, every police station every year lists how many strikes they had to suppress, right? So it's like, well, in this neighborhood, there wasn't anything like this year, or there were five things, right? So it was really a huge part of what the police did was they wouldn't have said suppress strikes, but they would have said police strikes, right? But in general, they were in the business of suppressing strikes, which meant they had to get the right people who are willing to do that, right? And that's going to be a process. Okay, so we have that. Let's get the next one. Don't know if that's, oh shoot. Okay, well, sorry. I thought I had an 1880. That's okay. We'll leave it there. I thought I had a Haymarket strike. Did anybody know what the Haymarket strike was? So the Haymarket Square, I guess it's not really a strike, the Haymarket Square incident, right, in 1886 was it 1886, was when basically there's a great big collective strike against the McCormick Works in Chicago. And somebody gets a bomb, somehow a bomb gets thrown into the police who are coming in. They're charging into this group that's having a rally, which is actually a socialist rally. And they're charging in, and somebody throws a bomb into the middle of these police. And it explodes and it kills, I think, four police officers. And nobody's ever really able to figure out to this day who threw it. But what they ended up doing was, like, the people who had been involved in leading the strike, they ended up, saying, well, you didn't throw the bomb, but you created the situation in which the bomb was thrown, and you probably knew about the bomb. So it was this big, they ended up executing a lot of people, and it was a big deal. But the reason that it was a really big deal was largely because all of this fear of chaos, which you could kind of see in 1874 with, like, the women's crusades, where, like, the women are coming out and saying, we have to, like, have more order. But then, like, also you can see it in 1877 with this huge national strike that maybe we don't even have the ability to suppress, right? And then over in Europe, you actually do have, right, huge, like, socialist, strikes and revolutions. And it's just like it's a really complicated time. So basically when this happens in 1885, 1886, everybody panics, right, in Pittsburgh. And even though the big strike is back in Chicago, everybody kind of says, the Haymarket strike, everybody kind of says, well, this could happen in Pittsburgh just as well, right? And so in 1886, 1887, we totally rebuild our police. We basically start from scratch, right? We basically fire all the police officers, hire a whole new bunch, set up an entire new system, fund them a lot better, because we're afraid, right? Largely, and this is very explicit, they talk about it in the newspapers, right? Because we're afraid of the, you know, of what's going on with sort of social chaos, largely with Haymarket. And it's interesting when they talk about firing all the existing police officers, they talk about what's wrong with them, right? And so there's all this hate for the police. Like, it's kind of funny when you're like, you know, because the police, usually you get a lot of respect from like, you know, public leaders, but not these police. So like before they fired them all, they were like, what's wrong with them? They're like, they're corrupt. You know, they're lazy. You know, they think we owe them everything just because they fought in war, in the Civil War, like years ago, right? They're like, these old guys, they think we're just going to keep on paying them just because they fought in the Civil War, right? So there's a lot of actually resentment and sort of for these Civil War veterans who now are, you know, by the 1880s are like older police. And so they're like, we're just going to like let them go. And, but also like, there, like, there's these stories, like, I saw a police officer the other day, and these are like public officials who are testifying about what's wrong with the police. They're like, I saw a police officer the other day, and he just walked up to a nut vendor on the street, and he just reached his hand in and took like a handful of those nuts and just ate them and just walked away, you know, and like, they're just like the worst, right? So everybody's just talking about how corrupt and awful these old police were. Which is incidentally the only way you hear about that, because as long as people are sticking with that system of police, they're like, they're great, you know, but then as soon as they're like, we have to change, they're like, those guys were absolutely the worst, right? And so, so that's what they do in 1886. They fire them all, and they start anew. And in fact, they really start anew. The average age, and by 1888, 2 years after, or really it's 1 year after this change, because the change is implemented in 1880, or it's decided on in 1886 and implemented in 1887. By 1888, the average age of the police was between 27 and 30. So they get a whole new generation of younger police who they think, I think, are more pliable, right? Because I think the other thing about these Civil War veterans is they're not necessarily going to do exactly what the civic leaders, you know, tell them to do, even though, because they have this clout, right? They have to get rid of those people. So they bring in this like new fresh group of like young people. They also bring in a new chief. And here is where we can move forward, not to call Chief Brown a tool, that I didn't really intend that, but he was kind of a tool, but he was also, you know, Chief Brown was going to be the head of the police, until almost, the beginning of the 20th century. He's going to be in there for many years. And he's actually, I think, pretty good. Like, I think he was, I have to say, I'm kind of a Chief Brown fan. But what he was he was a political tool of the machine. He was a good friend, and he was brought in not because he had experience policing, but because he was tied in with like the political machine, with McGee. But he has, because of that, he actually has a lot of power, and he's pretty smart. And I think he wants to police well. So he actually talks a lot about the problems of policing. He's very, reading his annual reports are fascinating, because he'll say, you know, people complain about police being corrupt. People complain about police violence. You know, he said, police are human, and they're going to make as many mistakes as anybody makes in whatever their line of work is. And so we have to come to terms with that. He's like, men are not angels, and neither are police. But he tries to build a system where the policing will work better than it has in the past. So he revamps the force. He becomes the first person who's called the director of public safety. And he's the one, Roger O'Mara, who you mentioned in your paper, right? In your research, Roger O'Mara is going to be his sidekick, who's brought in as assistant, and who's going to become the first head of the detective force. So one thing that's happening with the police during this time is they're going to get more professionalized. People are going to have specialized jobs. So for the first time, there's detectives who are actually going to go out and try to solve crimes, right? This is new, right? Instead of just trying to like chase people down, you know, and serve warrants and things like that. So Brown comes in, he brings in some of his own leaders, like Roger O'Mara, most importantly, replace the force with younger people, but they also have a lot of new technology. that can come to their assistance. And this is when you, when historians of the police talk about this period, they talk about this as like the period of police modernization. And it all hits pretty much exactly in 1887. Like all of this happens at once. And it was pretty amazing for the people who live there. Okay, so shall we push forward? Okay, so here's just a picture of, you know, some, these are actually lieutenants, just to get a sense of what these police officers would look like. It's still kind of fancy to get your picture taken. Like, you know, it's not new exactly, but it's expensive. So they didn't tend to take as many pictures of the officers, but we all the, I mean, of the, you know, on the street, you know, folks, but all the officers, we now have good pictures of them. So, okay, we want to move forward. Okay. But what they do have is they start using photography. The police starts actually getting their own photographer. And their photographer starts accumulating rogues' galleries. So they put it up on the wall, or actually, if anybody's interested, I can send a link. There's an awesome online, this is from a little bit later, but a Pittsburgh rogues' gallery from the early 20th century, where you can really, it's really fascinating. So basically, they'll just have a picture and, you know, they'll give like a description of the kind of crime or what this person's MO is and what their street names are and things like that. And they'll start doing things where the detectives will start doing things like mailing them to New York. Like, I think this is like a Chicago person. This may be like, you know, and, you know, whatever, you know, Slopey Wilson or something. And they'll be like, you know, sending things to, I think Slopey's come here. So they're starting to have this like larger, network where they're kind of talking to each other. And they start have these pictures are a big part of that. So they'll have these, and we don't quite have fingerprints yet. Fingerprints will really be coming into use at the beginning of the beginning of the 20th century. So part of this period, but not at the very beginning in the 1880s. Okay, we're ready for another bill. But this is like the most important. This is a call box. This is the Gamewell system. And so basically each neighborhood has a call box now. And so you can go to the call box and the police has a key for the call box and can open it up and could call headquarters and say, we have a problem out here. I need backup to help me arrest somebody, right? Or I have arrested somebody and I need to get them to the station. And then we're ready for the next picture here. They can send a Black Maria. And I don't have a picture of a Pittsburgh Black Maria from this, but that's basically a paddy wagon. They can send out a paddy wagon. And that was a revolution for police that used to have to just do whatever they could do on their own, or maybe get civilians to help them and then like get the person to the police station, however they could, right? To be able to walk over to a call box, call headquarters, and then immediately this, you know, Black Maria shows up. It felt like the future, right? I mean, it was like, it was a revolution in policing. And then regular people, like business owners particularly, could also have keys to the call box so that they could call the police. But they actually didn't want anybody to abuse it because people totally did, right? And so you actually had to stay, you had to keep your key in. You couldn't take your key out until the police got there. And then they'd give you, they would take it out and take your key out. But basically there's a revolution in policing with these, with this, you know, new transportation. And let's see, I think we have one. Yeah, we do have, here we go. We have police gyms. So the police start to be, I don't want to overstate this because police basically are still totally untrained and don't have any guidance on how to police. Still at this moment, there basically is just very little like rules about, you know, what you're supposed to do out there. But there is, they do start doing things like trying to keep them in physical shape. So each police station now is going to start having a gym, and they actually hire a boxing coach in Pittsburgh who's going to like teach the police to fight, teach the police to more effectively fight. Because up through the 1970s, at least, right, it was very common for police to basically have fist fights with people that they were arresting. And so they need to get better at fighting. So they're learning that. They also are learning now a shooting, right? And this is something else that comes in with the veterans, I think. right? I'm still trying to exactly piece it together, but I think what happens is that with the veterans, they're more comfortable with shooting. They bring in their guns, you know, but certainly it's the case that by the 1880s, it's much more common for the police to carry guns with them than it had been before the Civil War. Okay, there's other kinds of innovations as well that we don't have images of. There's bicycle squads. They introduce bicycle squads to patrol. They certainly have horse patrols, and particularly horse patrols are useful for suppressing strikes, right? So it's very common to bring in horses and just like charge the horses, right? You know, into a strike that has gotten out of hand. So the horse patrols, they have bike patrols. You're not going to do that with your bike, probably. They have, and there's a couple of other things they do too, which I'm going to start mentioning, but they start thinking a lot more about the health of police officers. They start hiring surgeons, police surgeons for the first time, and the police start getting regular medical care as police. And when they get injured on the job, that there's a guy whose job it is to help them. And they also start making these services available to people who are arrested. And they start keeping really good records of the health of police and also of people who are arrested. And so it's actually, it becomes really, really interesting. You could see, you know, what it's like to be a police officer in part through their records. And they do get like, you know, hit by a rock in the, you know, in the stomach or like, you know, head concussion or like, you know, things like that. But you also get suicides, you know, and I'd like to get the rate of that, but you actually have fairly substantial police suicide rate. And you do have, you know, some police getting shot, you know, things like that. But then when you look also at the records of folks who are brought into the jail and needing medical care, you can know that it's really tough. It's tough to be on the street, right? Because folks in jail have all sorts of just terrible medical problems, right? You know, some of which may have been caused by the police, who tended to like, the big thing at this point would be to hit somebody with your stick still, right? A lot of head concussions, a lot of slip and fall injuries. It was very frequent for people being arrested to have fallen and hit their head on the ground while they were being arrested, right? And, you know, they had cracked skulls and, you know, the kind of common knowledge was that was the baton, right? But they start taking care a little bit more of health and they start getting interested in things like pensions for police and like how to take care of, how to take care of them after they retire. Okay, they start standardizing hiring, start taking formal applications for police work. They start doing, at the beginning of the 20th century, some civil service reform comes in. So it gets a little more difficult to fire them. But like Brown, J.O. Brown, our person who I insulted as calling him a tool, he's basically, and Roger O'Mara, both of them are constantly complaining, you know, we keep firing people because they're bad, like because they're doing bad at their job. We keep firing them and then they keep reappearing. Like, you know, they can't, the police chief, and that's true today too, right? The police administration, one of their biggest headaches is that they don't really have the right to get rid of police officers who they don't think are doing a good job. And that was definitely the case at that time as well, because they had political power. After these reforms of 1886, of course, everything doesn't get, you know, magically better. Particularly, you guys probably see, and we're not gonna talk really about this, but the Homestead Strike of 1894 is a really big deal. Again, they're unable to mobilize the police to suppress that, even with these reforms. The police will not come out and suppress the Homestead Strike, right? And again, they have to, you know, bring in this case, Pinkerton detectives. They have to hire people to come in from New York City and Chicago to try to suppress that. And then that doesn't even work because they lose. And then they have to like call in again, the army basically to come in and suppress it. But so these reforms don't really solve the problem of being able to suppress the sort of constant strikes. But I also have another image that I think is so interesting. We want to go forward one more. This is 1894. It's the same year as the Homestead Strike. Has anyone ever heard of Coxey's Army? Coxey's Army. My mom always used to say, you guys are as hungry as Coxey's Army. And when I was a kid, but Coxey's Army, it was an army of the poor. That in 1894, there's an economic downturn. And so poor people start forming basically into armies and marching on the Capitol to demand. Some of them are demanding veterans benefits. But some of them, a lot of them are demanding sort of like currency reform, but they're basically demanding sort of like help for, you know, economic help because they are poor. And it actually starts in Massillon, Ohio, is the first one, but it spreads nationally. And so these armies are coming, like some from California. They actually are taking over railroad cars and getting on the railroad cars and taking them across the country, but they have like some support. So when this group, this is actually a group, they're actually in, this is in Beaver. I couldn't find one of them in Pittsburgh, but they did come to Pittsburgh. And when they came to Pittsburgh, they were greeted by like public officials, like the unions. They were fed, people figured out how to get like a huge amount of food to like feed the people, figured out where they could stay while they were here. And then like, you know, played music for them, right? And then like they're sent on their way to DC, right? All of this to say, the reason I want to mention them now, the police don't particularly have a role because the police don't address them because they're not really seen as, you know, needing to be stopped by the people of Pittsburgh. But I want to say this because this was a huge time of people don't understand how popular communism was here, but communism, anarchism, you know, socialism, you know, we're all really, really, no, anarchism less so, right? But even anarchism, right? We're actually really had a lot of political clout here in Pittsburgh, even among people who were fairly prominent, you know, even among political leaders, right? The idea that you need to have a little bit more like socialism or a lot more socialism, you know, in the labor unions, a lot of the important labor leaders were socialist. So you actually did really have this sort of potential of real political explosion, right? Or huge political change, which you know, maybe would be good, right? If you think that a socialist change would have been good. But the police are kind of like in the middle of this. There's this huge sort of like working, you know, demands coming and, you know, the demands from the poor. And then at the same time, you have like the police who are largely paid by, you know, they're more like the forces of order, right? But they're also like the forces of, I don't mean to be like, oh, they're just like trying to suppress, you know, labor. I mean, the police are also being demanded by people like these women who don't want to be beaten up or don't want to be harassed on the streets, right? And things like that. So the police are sort of being asked to do a lot of things. They're being asked to suppress this sort of huge disorder. And they're also being asked to like do all this sort of day-to-day, you know, business of sort of causing a pleasant, you know, environment for, you know, people to be able to use the streets. Okay. So let's get now to the bigger question of what is it that the police actually do during this time? So if we can go, who is being policed? What are the police doing? And I'm going to basically smush this period into one. I'll talk a little bit about how it changes over time. But I want to talk first of all about who is getting arrested. And so I went and spent some time looking through the police reports. So this is their own self-reporting of what they're doing. Cause they start, and one thing that I didn't even mention this, of the many accomplished, okay, here's the real reason why I'm a fan of Brown, J.O. Brown. Cause he started doing annual reports, right? Which is how we, you know, which is how we know a whole bunch about what the police are doing. And also, I mean, there were some things before that you could use, but these much better annual reports. And he keeps statistics on like every arrest, like who is this person? Where were they arrested? Why were they arrested? By whom were they arrested? Like he has all sorts of what is their race, right? What is their age? What is their ethnicity? So he starts keeping these really good records of like who's being arrested and why. So we know all this stuff going forward. We know, for instance, that if you look at the year 1899, you look at who is arrested. Everybody who was arrested was asked to give their form of employment. More than half of all the people arrested in 1899 gave the employment form laborer. Okay, so these are workers who are at the very bottom of the heap. They're unskilled laborers, right? Are almost always, not almost always, but more than half the time, unskilled laborers are the folks who are being policed, right? And then other, you know, really cheap, you know, people like waiters, right? You get a lot of waiters who are arrested, you know, but just like folks who are kind of at the bottom of the heap employment wise are also going to be the folks who are most likely to be arrested. Servants, people who give a servant are likely to be arrested. It's also a large part of the population, right? I don't have the percentage of people who were servants, though I can get that and I will for the book. But these folks are almost certainly over-policed. We could be pretty sure about that, that like either they're doing more, committing more crime, right? Or they're being, you know, more frequently arrested when they do, probably both, right? But they certainly get arrested at a great number. Okay. What else do we know about the folks who are arrested? Okay, what percentage of people arrested are women? Anybody want to guess? 2%. See, you think well of women. It's not, it's a little worse than that. It's 10%. And that number stays pretty much consistent over time. Like it's almost always like, and over culture, it's like, you know, it's like, it's amazing how frequent it is for like 90% of all arrests to be women. It's who knows, right? I cannot explain why. I have some theories, but yeah, about 90% throughout this entire period of people who are arrested are going to be men. The age range is what you would expect. About a third of everybody arrested, is going to be between 20 and 30 years old. A third of those arrested are going to be men between 20 and 30 years old. That's not even including the few women who are arrested. 25% of arrested people are men from 30 to 40. 13% of those arrested are men in their 40s. 12% of those arrested are boys in their teens. So it's about what you'd think, though I think they're not arresting kids as much as they will be by the next session that we talk about. I'll give you those. I'll try to remember to tell you if that's true. Okay. They're under arresting Black Pittsburghers, according, you know, just a little bit. It's actually a little bit less in this period, the arrest rate for Black, which really surprised me. Yes. Women are largely going to be arrested for theft. Drunkenness, are there going to be the big ones like order violations, you know, public disorder, but also prostitution, you know, that's their own category. Yeah. But largely it's going to be just like the men, it's going to be public disorder and drunkenness, some larceny. And then after that prostitution. Yeah. Okay. The last thing I want to mention, who is over arrested is foreign born people. During this period, about a quarter of 1897, about a quarter of the population is foreign-born, and foreign-born people are arrested more like 30%, if the arrests are foreign-born. So they are arresting foreign-born people more, and particularly they're arresting, one-eighth of everybody who was arrested in Pittsburgh in 1898 was born in Ireland, right? So the Irish get really heavily policed, the biggest percentage of arrested people. Germans after that, then Polish people, then the English. The Welsh are definitely really overrepresented among arrestees, right? it's going to switch after the 1890s. You're going to get more folks from Eastern Europeans, right? We're going to start cranking up a little more than them. Okay, and then the last thing I want to say, because I know we're getting towards the end of the time here, but what are people arrested for? And again, this almost gets a little boring because it's true at all times and all places. Like, but this is what people are arrested for. Almost everybody who's arrested is arrested on, or the vast majority arrested on, order violations, right? And again, that's like today. People get arrested, almost, you know, the vast majority of people that the police arrest are arrested for being disorderly in public. They're being disorderly in public. And I clumped some categories together to come up with this, but it was basically a combination of drunkenness, public disorder, vagrancy. I put suspicious persons in this category. Though I could have, some of those were probably suspected of theft, right? But it was basically being somewhere where nobody really knows, you know, why you're there, and using public space in a way that people, a lot, some people, at least the people who control the police, don't think you should be using it, right? And so it's order violations are about, I don't know, what is that, 80% or something, 80 or more percent of the arrests. Morals violations are in there in the orange, and that's prostitution. It's also gambling. It's running a gambling den, running a disorderly house, or, you know, being a pimp or whatever, you know, is like order, moral violations. And it's also during this period, sodomy. There's very little arrest actually for sodomy. That's pretty uncommon, but, or bigamy would also be in this category. That's a very, very small numbers, like one or two per year, for either sodomy or bigamy, maybe a little bit more for sodomy. Now, we'll talk a little bit, we won't talk too much about sodomy, but we'll talk a little bit more about sodomy, but, some of those arrests, involve underage people too. So it's interesting, like, you know, it's a little bit complicated how they're policing sodomy. Okay. Property, is like what, 2% or something like that are all of the theft cases, which is largely larceny. And then violent offenses is like 1%, which is all assaults, assaults on police, you know, murder, you know, whatever, all of those things together. So largely what the police are doing, again, just like the early police, is they're sort of like keeping the public spaces, orderly, right? However they want to define orderly, or kind of deciding what the appropriate use of public spaces are and enforcing that. Okay, but that would also include like strike suppression, right? Things like that. So, okay. Well, I'm going to say, the last thing I'm going to say here is that one of the most important things, and we're not going to really get too much of a chance to talk about it because we're out of time, but one of the most important things that happens in policing happens in 1915, when the first police union, the first fraternal order of police in the country, is formed in Pittsburgh. And that's the Fort Pitt FOP. It started in 1915. And what's interesting about that is that the police can never decide if they're professional or if they're workers, right? And there's a really good reason they can't decide that, right? It's a really complicated position that they're in, right? And they can never really decide whether they're professionals or whether they're workers. Professionals don't unionize usually, right? Police, especially not during this time. And so what they're actually doing is kind of both. So at the same time that they form a union, and which is going to grow pretty quickly, and nationalize, the same time that they form their union, they're also like developing a police journal, right? Which is something you do when you're an academic discipline or like a professional discipline. So they're trying to be both at once, and they're trying to kind of fit themselves kind of, you know, as people who have to work manually, they have to work with their hands. And as people who often, I mean, I think weren't treated very well, at the same time, they were people who, had a lot of authority and had a certain amount of clout. And so they're trying to sort of figure out how to fit themselves into the system of professions, like during this time. So, okay, well, I will stop here, and any questions?
I'm stunned with the violence track of how small it is.
I think that's still true today. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, we'll have to, I mean, I should know better, but because I never look after, I make it a point not to look after 2000 because I don't want to get in any fights. but yeah, it's not, that's not too far from what it is now. Police largely, and what they would say is like, oh, it's preventative policing, right? You know, if you get the people, so what happens in the 1980s is like, it's like, well, if you stop the small things from happening, then like the big things won't happen. So that's kind of the philosophy of it. You catch the suspicious persons, they'll never get to do the things, right?
Violence is what gets the headlines.
Yeah.
The blue doesn't get the headlines.
Yeah.
So I think what's in the press is distorted from whatever the guns
are. Yeah, and most violence happens, I mean, inside the home, I think. This is just me guessing, but I imagine most violence happens inside the home, and police aren't very good at getting at that.
What do you mean that's like bigger?
Well, if we looked at actual acts of violence, right, that like it would be nice if it was police, like we might get a lot of things that didn't make it onto that chart, right? But the police aren't very good at getting into the places where the violence happens. The police can only, you know, only kind of, well, only if they're called in, right, which they often aren't. So, I mean, I kind of think it is interesting to think about this because it's not that violence doesn't happen, but I think it's that like the matchup between what police are able to do and the violence that happens isn't as good as you would hope that it would be, is what I think. Yeah.
My question is a little bit more theoretical here, but as a WASP, you know, I grew up, police were respected. And that what they said was the truth, and you very rarely challenge that. Now we're living in an era where some of those skins of the onion are being peeled back. But is this a time that police started to be respected more, at least among certain segments of the society? Because you mentioned up until then they weren't that much respected, and what they said was just assumed to be true. Is this when that started to build up, and how long did that continue? I'm assuming that was, at least as a white WASP, that was a presumption.
No, I think that's really, I think there's a truth there. It's really fascinating when you read police talking about whether they're respected. They're going to complain all the way through that they're never respected, right? So when you read like police, like poetry, like police will write like poetry, or like there'll be like, you know, like bulletins that like police share with each other, and they will often say, or they'll make like political cartoons, like police will draw political cartoons. We have some really nice ones from Pittsburgh, and they'll be like, nobody ever respects us, right? And so there's always this kind of sense going through that like they're not, they always feel like they're, you know, not always, but they often feel like they're not sufficiently respected. However, it certainly is the case, and we'll get up to like, I think we're stopping at the 1950s, but it certainly is the case in the 1950s, and I'm going to say up to the year 1966, right, when everything seems to fall apart for the police. I would say up to that point, like you really do get, like you go out and interview people. There was like this great, it was like, I want to say it was in 1960. There's this, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette does a, goes out and interviews families of color, people of color. And they say like, do you think the police are unfair or whatever? And it's like 1960, whatever. And it's like 95%, no, the police are awesome. You know, I don't believe that there's any problem with the police, right? And that's like, my belief is that, and then like, I've been watching Vintage Dragnet and stuff like that. You know, I've been in there and like the, you know, but like, you know, I do think that like kind of there was this period of time right after World War II. And I kind of think that was, we think of that as the norm, but I think that was maybe the exception, because I think that what happens after World War II, my guess, and this is a period I haven't really worked that much on, but the folks are probably, again, military veterans largely. And they have that sort of clout. You know, and I think there's just something about the 50s are a little bit different, but like certainly I mean, also in the 1930s, you have a lot of popular culture that celebrates the police. I'm sorry, the 1920s. You have a lot of popular culture that's going to celebrate the police because you're having like all the sort of, you know, cops and robbers. You have all the bootleggers and like, you know, so you start getting a lot of sort of heroic depictions of like, you know, master police who are like out there, you know, fighting it out with these bootleggers, you know, and that gets to be really big, especially the feds, but it also sort of like, you know, trickles down to the police. So I feel like the police actually get a lot of admiration in the 1920s. And then I think they're not so popular. I'm going to say maybe 1930s are really the days of a lot of sort of communist sentiment, a lot of concern in the 1930s about the third degree and sort of like police brutality that starts to come in. That's very big. A lot of sort of like protests against the police, and you start getting Black Pittsburghers protesting against the police a lot in the 1920s and 1930s, but especially the 1930s. So I don't know. I think maybe like the days of the where the police have the highest sort of like PR, you know, or like popular respect, I think that's going to be like the 1940s because it's the war, right? The 1940s, the 1950s, and then maybe also the 1920s. That's kind of what I think. I don't know.
Did your study include allied professionals who work with the police, like forensic specialists who work with mass murderers like Charles Manson? And if so, when did that start occurring? I don't know.
I haven't looked at that. What I'm really interested in, I mean, what my actual interest is policing. I'm interested in like the interactions. What I'm really interested in, I wanted to write an entire book on the arrest and what happens when people are arrested. That was the original idea, was that interaction between the person who is arrested and the person who is doing the arresting. What does that feel like for them?
So is this more the rehabilitation of a criminal, you know, in the prison system, and they'll have a forensic psychiatrist dealing with a psychopathic personality who are considered curable, but they need a specialist to treat them.
Yeah, because you get the rise of professional psychiatry, right? And that's going to be in the psychiatrist. One thing you get is like the battle between professions, right? About like who's going to get the criminal justice money, right? And the or the power, or you know, I don't mean to put it in a cynical way, but like you have that was cynical, but like you know, I do think that one thing you have is you have the medical folks who are stepping in and saying, well, the main thing they say is we can deal with the drinkers. Right. You know, we can. So the medical people manage to sort of like get control of that huge disorderly population who is over drinking. But I think at around that same time, so it's going to be like really by this period, by the late 19th century, you have the rise of professional psychiatry. And they do start like, you know, thinking about you start getting insanity defenses and things like that, getting much more successful. Right. And, you know, and also, you know, alcoholism defenses and things like that get much more successful by like the 1880s, 1890s and stuff like that. So I think that I haven't really focused on, you know, serial killers or anything like that, because they're such a small part of I'm interested in kind of like the kind of the broader population. But yeah, no, psychiatrists get themselves into the story beginning in like, I'm going to say the 1880s. Yeah.
This is Ted. I'm a little slow, and I just want to make sure I understand this. 80% of arrests, you know, for violations of order. What does that really represent? I mean, is this just people who are misbehaving and you know, getting drunk and causing trouble? Is that?
Yeah. No, it's so what it is I put together and I looked through because I wanted to make sure it was consistent. I actually just this week went through a whole bunch of different annual reports, and it's pretty consistent. It's more like 90% usually, you know, are order violations of all arrests. But it's vagrancy, disorder, you know, just disorderly conduct, drunkenness, suspicious persons. And suspicious persons is the one I was least comfortable putting in this category, because they often would put somebody in as a suspicious person if they were like, they thought they were trying to steal something. So if somebody was like going through a neighborhood or something and they're like, why is that guy here? That would be a suspicious person. So it's like order violations, but you could also add, they would arrest people for being, what was the category that was, so I was just like, really? But they would arrest people for being like demented, you know, the charge would be like, you know, the person was like demented or whatever, you know, but it was basically like, you know, people who were making everybody uncomfortable around them, or making some people uncomfortable around them in the street. So I think, I mean, I really do think that like mainly what the police are charged with doing is making it so that like, you know, women particularly, this is the first time, like the 1880s is like the first time that respectable women can really walk through the streets on their own. They don't have to have a male escort. And they're, you know, it's, you can go to work, you know, as a woman, and, you know, you're supposed to be able to do that without being harassed. It's not just like, in general, I think it's a problem that there's so many order violations, but it is really complicated, right? Because it's like, well, should children be able to walk through the streets? Should women be able to walk through the streets without feeling uncomfortable? And that's part of what the police are charged with doing, sort of like creating that space where people who are not physically strong can use that public space on their own.
So would it be wrong to say that it's like a perceived threat of a perceived threat that doesn't progress to violence necessarily, but sort of somehow hasn't, you know, like exists on the edge of that?
Yeah, I think that's what it is. I think it's that like people, it's arresting people because they make other people feel uncomfortable. And that there's an idea that you should be able to not feel uncomfortable, when you're on the street. But yeah, I think you could all really be put in the bucket of preventative policing. Cause it's like, I actually brought with me, cause I didn't know what to do with it, but I think I brought it in here with me. Yeah. It's just an article that I just found this morning. It says it's from 1919, so the end of this period. It says the title is Raids on Pool Rooms and Lodging Houses Made to Check Crime. And basically what they say that they did, this is from the Daily Post, Pittsburgh Daily Post. What they say that they did was they basically went and raided all the pool rooms and lodging houses and places where men were assembling, because there's a big strike in 1919, right? There's a lot of disorder, and there's also race riots in a lot of cities, though not in Pittsburgh particularly. So they, in order to sort of like prevent something from happening, they basically go into the pool rooms and lodging houses and they arrest everybody who can't account for, they can't account for their means of living. So they go into places where men are hanging out. And if they don't have a means of employment, they literally get arrested. Right. And so, does this seem fair? No. I mean, are the police what they think they've been asked to do this, right? It's their job. What people think is happening is that, like, if you take all the disorderly people who, you know, might cause problems out, well, then you won't have any more problems. So that's preventative policing.
Well, see, we've gone over the 9:45 mark, and I'll just say that this has been fascinating, continues to be. Can't wait to hear the grand finale next week. And I'll stop the recording shortly, but just say thank you very much.
Thank you.